Cheers to a great day and this ice-cold Corona.
You know what would make this day even better? My grandma's carne asada.
Throw in some music.
We can watch the game. Or we could keep it simple.
Corona, la vida más fina. Get your Corona at ordercorona.com. Relax responsibly. Corona Extra Beer, imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
People will have a tendency to see you as that character from their memory and not from how old you are now and things like that. It takes a long time to move past people's first impressions. That's something that affects people at all points in their career, no matter how successful you are.
Stereotypes about child stars and their longevity in Hollywood are well known. We've all heard the same tragic stories, but contrary to popular belief, there's a larger number of us child actors who have actually beaten the odds and, we continue on our showbiz journeys. These are our stories. I'm Jaleel White, and this is Ever After. My guest today is probably one of the most recognizable faces in film. His film debut came as Tom Hanks' son in Forrest Gump. He's best known as an unwilling young medium in M. Night Shyamalan's Sixth Sense, for which he received an Academy Award nomination. I like to remind people of that. Then it was on to Steven Spielberg's sci-fi smash, Artificial Intelligence. More recently, though, he starred in TV series Future Man, Bad Therapy. He's got a ton of awesome TV credits, but I got to fan guy out a little bit. I loved him in Silicon Valley as Kanan. Allow me to welcome Haley Joel Osment.
Hey, how's it going, man?
What's going on, man? It's good to have you, Doc. Good to be talking
with you.
Now, do you prefer Haley or Haley Joel?
Haley is fine. I don't even know how that got started. I have a suspicion, like, a second AD at some point put it on the call sheet, and, like, we just sort of went with the three. Because in regular life, it's always just been Haley, but I don't know how the three names got added.
That's hilarious. I was starting to make an association that, like, great young actors have, like, three names.
That and assassins, right?
Right?
It's the three-name structure.
It's funny, you. I think we've worked with a lot of the same people. I saw that you worked with Rob Corddry
Bad Therapy.
Bad Therapy. Yeah. I worked with him on Children's Hospital.
Oh yeah, that's a hilarious show. Yeah, he's fantastic.
Yeah, oh, hysterical. Yeah, hysterical though. Who is like the funniest person that you've ever worked with? Like, they're naturally funny.
I've worked with a lot of people like that. And it always makes the experience of being on set a lot of fun. You know, just being able to hang out with someone like that. Rob is definitely like that. I did a mini series called The Spoils of Babylon, where we just had an embarrassment of riches when it came to hilarious comedy actors. Getting to work with, like, Kristen Wiig on that. Just folks like that that are just so, so funny. And, you know, our mutual friend Lamorne, too, I've worked with him on three different projects now. And he's definitely one of those people who makes the set a great place to hang around.
Lamorne is great, especially when it comes to alts. You know, I love that about comedy for people don't know what we're talking about. But, you know, generally on a single camera shoot, you know, you'll get a chance on the third and the fourth pass if it gets that deep. To just do different alternative versions of a line or, you know, a little bit of dialogue.
Yeah.
So some people are just really good at that. Nick Offerman just laid me out working with him. I mean, that dude has a dry comedy that hits. It hits. You also did a Robot Chicken episode, and I was with Seth Green last week.
That's right.
I was with Seth Green last week.
Yeah, that's a really fun show to work on.
Yeah. Do you play ping pong by any chance?
I do. Yeah. I just,
okay. That's where I thought I where we ran into each other.
Oh, at the Kershaw thing. Yeah. No, I think ours was many years before. I think, I actually do remember this pretty well, but in 1994, I think it was the first time I went to Upfronts in New York. I was on a show called Thunder Alley at the time. And I think you and I were staying at the same hotel, but like I met you in the lobby and then I think I ran into you again at Tavern on the Green where they were having some, you know, network event and stuff like that. So
I remember that little boutique hotel they would stick us in, dog.
I remember that.
And then
really
Tavern
well.
On the Green afterwards with all the pictures taken and everything with the affiliates.
Yeah, that's a crazy experience to go through, particularly as a kid. And I was gonna ask you, what lot did you guys shoot Family Matters on?
We shot Family Matters on Burbank Warner Brothers.
Okay. Because about the same time I was doing that show, we were at ABC, like right across the way right there. So,
Because did
they ever do like rap parties at that like equestrian center in Burbank? Like they'd always I feel like I ran into you there once too. It'd be like this place that, you know, because there are a lot of kids on those shows. So like the cast and crew could go there, but it was also like relatively family friendly after recording.
Man, I think you worked on richer white productions than us, man. We would go to Pizza Hut, you know. We didn't get the entire equestrian center. I know where that damn place is.
Yeah, it's right in between those two lots, but yeah.
I think the thing that bonded me with you, though, unknowingly, when I saw you at the Kershaw Challenge, though, and for you know, those of you who are listening, the Kershaw Challenge is a ping pong competition that Clayton Kershaw of the Dodgers has annually. And it's so missed this year, man. I do it every year with like George Lopez and Jason Bateman, and all these great names. And this guy I saw strolling by one year and I was just like, that is the only man in this building who understands how many times I've heard "Did I Do That?" Because he has his own "I See Dead People" version. Understanding.
Yeah, that is.
And I wanted to.
That is a very specific experience that few people have gone through.
You know, it's a thing. I try to describe it because it's like, I also have a sixth sense for somebody who is well adjusted in our business, and it's almost kind of like, it's a relief when you cross paths. You know, I just talked to Kiki Palmer. Obviously I spoke to Seth last week and it's just kind of like, it's a relief. It's like, okay, I can just shorthand talk what this is about.
Exactly.
You know, but sometimes when I'm never offended by the catchphrase, I have to literally take it person by person and context.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that you experience the same thing where it's like, you know, with people coming up to you and saying the line as if you've never heard it from anybody else before.
Yeah, particularly in the very beginning, that was kind of amazing to see that the people would think that no one had ever thought to do that before in public. But it happens in really surreal ways too. Like just at Dodger Stadium, I was at a game and they do those little between the innings, they have the players do like trivia and stuff like that. And one of the segments ended with Yasiel Puig on the big screen doing the line. I was like, whoa, like that's just you don't expect it to show up in places like that. Yeah.
Right. So when that happens and they put you on a jumbotron, I hope you were in the dugout seats.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's always a very tempting thing to splurge on, man. That's the way to see a game.
If they put you on a jumbotron with somebody saying your catchphrase, if you're not sitting in the dugout seats, get ready. The line of pictures is about to form.
I'm just as likely to be up in the top deck, though. I really have been pretty crazy with the Dodgers over the past, you know, the seven amazing seasons that they've had now that I've been living in LA more often. And last night I was able to watch an actual exhibition game on television, which has been a huge relief, you know, now that there's no sports on television. So it's something.
It's so surreal seeing the player sit in the stands and call it a dugout like that.
Yeah. And they're allowed to tweet now, which I hope they keep letting the players tweet when they're sitting up there in the stands.
That's what we do when we're sitting in the stands.
Exactly. Exactly. Now I was going to ask you, did they have to ask your permission to put that one scene in Wolf of Wall Street when there's that fight? Because that's a great scene to show up in.
I love that.
I love that.
Yes, they did have to ask my permission. And I think that's one of those things where, again, that's somebody I have a lot of respect for, Leo, and obviously Martin Scorsese, that whole darn cast. So
yeah.
when you get that call from Warner Brothers, be like, all right, are you authorizing it?
Absolutely.
Like, yeah, yeah, why not? Let's see what they do with it. I've authorized worse. Yep. So that was cool. It's amazing how many people, like, again, same thing. As soon as a clip like that appears in a movie like that, everybody feels the need to text me like they're the only one who texts me.
Yeah.
I think that we both got in the business at the same time.
Yeah, I think so.
How old were you?
I was born in 1988 and I was 4 when I did my first thing. So about 1992.
Okay, I was born earlier than that and I was 3. I was 3.
Nice. Yeah.
You seem like you, your dad was very involved in your preparation during that time and obviously beyond. Like, he seemed to prepare you more than your average kid, not just memorizing your lines, but really giving you like context about your scenes and stuff like that. From what I understood, M. Night Shyamalan, bottom line, he's come out and he said like your audition for Sixth Sense was like the best audition that he'd ever conducted. And he was just blown away. Now, you know, and directors want to sell films, so they embellish. But, you know, I peep your intellect and I think he was probably telling the truth. Like, what was that process with your dad preparing for roles even back then at such a young age?
It really made all the difference having that resource of someone who my dad studied theater in college and actually ran a theater on Santa Monica Boulevard in the 80s, which is why he and my mom first moved out here from Alabama. And you spoke about Jason Bateman. He actually ran that theater with Kent Bateman, Jason's father at the time. So he knew Jason when he was like a teenager, also getting started in his career. But having someone who not just knew something about acting, but came from a theater background helped with so much of that preparation stuff. And even if it was for a sitcom or, you know, doing an audition for a movie, learning how to study a character and study the script and, you know, have this really organic process of, you know, getting to the final product really made the difference. And that audition for the Sixth Sense was probably the best example of that, because it's such a long process for that. I went in for the casting director first, then there's another round with the producers, and then only the third time around you go in with Knight. And so it's doing the scene many, many, many times over a few weeks and not having it get stale and still trying to, you know, to get to that same emotional place and everything. And having that rehearsal with my dad was just crucial with all that. So
it was. I really feel like even at that age, you were going, I can't let this get stale.
Yeah.
I got to tip my hat to that.
It's yeah.
take me through your what it was to be nominated for an Academy Award. You know, I won 3 NAACP Image Awards.
Nice.
But none of that compares to an Academy Award nomination. I always felt like a deep connection when a young person either was nominated or won the award. I mean, I was very aware of Anna Paquin at that age.
Yeah.
I was very, you know, I was aware of when you were nominated and just what that was at that age. Like, was it just nonchalant at that age, or did you know, like, whoa, this is...
I think it's... With a lot of things, you know, and that's probably, you know, the award season is an extreme example of it. But when you're that age, you're too young to really be concerned about a lot of stuff or like to really understand all of the craziness that surrounds it. So it makes it better in a way because you don't feel a lot of pressure or anything. And one thing that I did notice, and I had just had my first meeting with Steven Spielberg right before I went to the Oscars, and he was saying, pay attention to all these big stars that you've seen on the screen running around like, you know, like they're movie fans because, you know, they are fans of each other and everything. So everybody is kind of overwhelmed by the experience and just happy to see the people that they admire and that they've been fans of on screen. And that was the case. I feel like that was kind of like the height of like award shows influence too. Like the ceremony was like 5 hours long. And like, that was when ratings were still, it's before they've started trimming everything down and there's been like all that stuff. So it was a really surreal time to kind of be there at the shrine, seeing all that stuff.
The shrine.
Yeah.
You weren't even at the
Kodak yet.
You're
before
at the shrine
that. Yeah.
auditorium. That's crazy.
Yeah.
the shrine is like only where Farrakhan speaks.
Yeah.
Now. That's crazy.
Yeah,
that's,
I see like a dubstep show there now.
Exactly. Oh my gosh. You took me back with the shrine. I felt that kid, Roman Griffin Davis from Jojo Rabbit.
Oh yeah.
I felt he got gypped. I thought he got gypped. I was like, that kid should have been nominated. That movie was phenomenal. His performance was adult level and completely like he knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
This was not just some kid stumbling through a movie and on his cute looks.
Yeah, that I really loved that movie. And yeah, the there some of the other kids in that, they don't have as big a role, but like all the kid actors in that movie are fantastic.
Yeah, so, that little chubby kid with the glasses,
yeah,
whatever
hilarious.
He was. I wish I could describe him more respectfully, but you know, that dude was dope.
I think Taika is definitely really good with working with children on screen, because that's hard to do. I got really lucky working with directors who really knew how to do that and didn't use any tricks or anything to try and get what they needed, but you know, really treated the younger actors with respect. That made all the difference in my career. And I can see it when you see films with performances like that now, you're like, oh yeah, I know that the on-set environment was great.
I come from an era where a director would actually physically move you to your position. So
wow.
Right, and think nothing of it. Here, you stand here. They just put their hands on both of your shoulders. You stand here. And
wow.
They do it to a woman they invariably do it to a woman or a child all the time.
Oh, man.
And so it's definitely a different skill set dealing with kids. What do you think is the number one skill set that a guy like, you know, Spielberg or Shyamalan has in dealing with younger people?
There's a practical aspect to it where I think Steven is one of the greatest examples of like responding to the way that film sets could be kind of sleazy in the 70s and like not a safe environment. Like I think his reaction to seeing that was always wanting to create a safe set where, like, you know, it would be an okay place for a kid to be. And I saw how much he cared about that, being a father himself. And just trusting the actor you've hired to understand the character and to go through the script with them. A helpful aspect of that is that when you're working on a studio film, and obviously certainly with the Spielberg film, you have the budget to have time to meet beforehand and to rehearse with all the actors. And having that rehearsal before we start shooting anything, I think really makes a big difference with the final product. That's a rare thing to find these days.
You took the words out of my mouth. I'm like, it is, people have no idea what a luxury rehearsal is.
Mm-hmm.
Now. Like, you got a chance to work on productions where rehearsal was paramount. It was provided for. The cost wasn't even thought of.
Yeah.
You were just, you know, you had every advantage of knowing what you were going to do before it was finally camera up.
Yeah.
And now it's like, I just feel like you're getting a set. You get one day to try on your wardrobe.
Yeah.
This woman has 24 hours to freaking fix it. And then you're on the set with complete strangers and you have to create chemistry. And it's just like, wow, what a different exercise.
Oh, yeah.
It's become. Thank you, Tyler Perry, for doing that to all of us. Thank you. now, wait, are you in the Academy?
Yes. Yeah, I think
that is
if
badass.
You get nominated, you get. And like they changed the rules recently because they've been trying to make a lot of changes with the Academy, because I think the average age was so high. Like a lot of it were people who had not, who were retired or had not worked in a while. So I think now it's like you have to have been in a movie like every 5 years or something. So I'm sneaking under the wire with that one. Hopefully they count streaming series.
That's crazy. You have to be in a movie every 5 years to keep your
something
voting rights
like
in the
that.
Academy.
Yeah.
But you have to act every year to keep your freaking SAG benefits.
Yes, yeah.
So we prefer you die rather than vote. We prefer you die rather than vote. Oh, gosh. After Sixth Sense, though, something I learned about you, though, was that you went back to normal school and you said it really helped that the kids your age hadn't seen Sixth Sense.
Yeah, that really made it a lot easier for me, because they were aware of the film and knew that I was doing stuff like that. But it was also a time where everybody didn't have a smartphone and social media. So like being in school at that time, like it was protected from all of that, from media and the entertainment industry and things like that, where kids working now, I think it's way harder for kids, trying to manage a career with that aspect of it, because you know, it's just, there's so many negative things that you can't filter out when that stuff is happening. So it's a, yeah. My, and the difference that I saw was my sister's also an actor, but she's 4 years younger than me. So by the time she was doing stuff on the Disney Channel and stuff like that, it was required that they have, you know, a social media presence, that we're engaging with that. And that's just a very overwhelming thing to do. I don't think I would have handled it well. I enjoyed being able to go work. And then when I wasn't working, it was just, you know, I wasn't doing anything with it. I wasn't having to manage anything about the career. I was just in school.
I can tell you enjoy your anonymity.
Yeah, definitely. It's been, and that was part of me, although it's sort of ironic that it was New York that made it possible. Like living in that city, it was really easy to sort of do your own thing and to not constantly be involved in things with the entertainment industry. You know, it's such a densely populated city, but everybody, I think, does their own thing a little bit more aggressively there than in Los Angeles. So, and now we're all really isolated. So the anonymity is just going off. Yeah.
How have you been enjoying your anonymity during COVID? Because I'm not going to lie, bro. Yeah. The mask thing has been fantastic.
I know. I think I'll just keep doing it. It's been great.
I go everywhere, dude. I mean, I go to the most ghetto spots for my favorite chicken sandwich. I stand in the longest lines. You know, I'm like, I'm not even trying to get around the line. I'm like, screw it. I'll stand on my little dial. Yeah. I'll stand on my little dial.
I love the mask. It's weird for a lot of reasons to see how angry it makes people that there's even a suggestion that they should have to wear it. But I think it's just great.
Oh, that's nuts. That I mean, that really says a lot, though, just about adults.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I have to teach my daughter. I have an 11-year-old daughter that I teach her that adults are stupider than kids. And because it's just like, I mean, what's your position on masks? My position on masks is kind of like when I'm outside, I'm not going to wear a mask if I'm working out.
Yeah.
If I'm working out and I'm socially distanced, I don't want to breathe that way.
Yeah.
But if I go into any store where all of us are now subjected to shopping, protecting the cashier or anything like that, or even in somebody's house.
Yeah.
You know, I enter with my mask as a respect.
Yeah.
And then if I discover that someone in that home is comfortable removing their mask or whatever, and you're just keeping safe distance, then all right, I kind of go with the flow. But the no mask at all people, like you won't tell me what to do people. I just feel like we're all kids who didn't get spanked.
Yeah.
Like,
and especially like going into someone's store and being like, I'm going to breathe all over. I refuse to follow your rules. Because those are some of the people at the highest risk, or people at grocery stores and things like that, where there's just a constant inflow of people. And a big statistical finding, I think, is that when the protests first started in early June, I think everybody was worried like, oh, it's people closely packed outside. Like there's going to be a huge spike. There has not been a spike in New York. There hasn't been a spike traced to protests. And it was mostly because we believe everybody was wearing a mask. The ones that I went to in LA, I was very nervous about the virus, but everybody was wearing a mask and there hasn't been a huge spike as a result. So it's just, I think it shows it's a really easy, effective way to do it. If you're outside and if you're wearing a mask when you're close to somebody, it's helpful to keep away from this terrible disease.
I want to stay on anonymity just a little
bit,
because I just feel like for a guy who's heard I see dead people and did I do that as much as we have, it just, people will never understand how much I savor my moments of anonymity. During college, I was known for wearing sunglasses.
Yeah.
And I didn't know I was known for wearing sunglasses until I picked up the Daily Bruin, and some jackass young reporter just threw me under the bus. Like, oh, he can frequently be seen around campus wearing his dark specs. It was like you could just tell the guy went out of his way to let everybody know he thinks he's cooler than us. And it's like, no, it's actually not. I had another actor explain to me one time, like, why Jack Nicholson would, like, wear his sunglasses, even, like, down on the court.
Yeah.
And it was because everybody's looking at him.
Yeah.
So when he wears his sunglasses, when you get closer to him, you're uncomfortable looking at him. So he gets a little bit of privacy back.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? So it's like, and if you think about it, it really makes sense. It's like, if you're Jack Nicholson on a court and, you know, some hot chick walks by or something like that, you don't want people looking at you, look at her.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So it's like, it's a way of psychologically getting some of your privacy.
Absolutely. Back. Yeah. And it also helps prevent, like, if you're being photographed either surreptitiously by someone or, you know, with a telephoto lens, you know, they always go for the ones where, like, you're halfway blinking or, like, there's just so many opportunities to. It's that one they were saying recently is they like getting women when they're sneezing because it makes it look like they're crying. I was like, that's such a mean, like, terrible thing to do. So wearing sunglasses helps, like, block that a little bit, that it helps just sort of keep it as. Yeah. And now with the mask, it's over. You can't see anything. It's perfect protection.
And it has been funny watching the tabloid pictures of celebrities in their masks.
Yes. They still know. With some people, it's like they still are able to follow their movements somehow. Yeah. That's that was one thing that really changed dramatically right when I left LA for college, is there was that the rise of, like, you know, TMZ and things like that, where it was like a much more aggressive kind of, you know, tracking of people and stuff like that. And I think it doesn't seem as pronounced now, but back then, like, it just really had an effect on, like, the culture in LA, where, like, everybody was looking for an opportunity to pay someone off for information. Like, I would talk to multiple people at, like, hotels and certain places. They were like, you know, some, you know, jerk teenager from TMZ is like, how much money do you want to tell me, like, who's what number room this person is in or stuff like that? And you're just like, it creates this nasty environment for everybody. It's like, that wasn't very cool.
I'm blown away, dog, that you went to New York to act.
Yeah.
Like, you went to college to act. I played, like, Scrooge in a fifth grade play once, and I was just like, these kids are so unprofessional and nobody's hitting their mark. and you like intentionally, like, went to NYU to act with your peers. Like, I just commend you for that.
Thank you.
And tell me about that experience.
There were a couple of years in there where I didn't work on anything professional at all. And those years were actually, like, probably some of, you know, the best years of my life, because I had not worked a lot with people my own age growing up. And all of a sudden it was just basically a conservatory program with only people my age, and getting to create work with people like that, to learn a lot from people who had much more experience than I had on stage. The program I went to was the experimental theater wing at NYU, and there was a wide variety of performers in that program. There was my friend got hired into Cirque du Soleil, like, right out of college. Like, there was, you know, dancers and choreographers and writers and just a wonderful a variety of people who all had different goals for themselves. And that gave me a lot of, you know, inspiration for whatever I'm going to do with the rest of my career.
You know, that's wow. When I think back of, I got to back up. Like, so you took some real time for yourself in 2003, and where you didn't work. And I think you had a cool job. As a matter of fact, you worked on you did voiceover for Kingdom of Hearts.
Yeah.
And that was what you did kind of during that time. And like, my version of that was, I was the voice of Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yeah. That's right.
And it was, but it's like this thing we both have where I love it when somebody comes up to me and recognizes me for Sonic. And I'm sure you love it when somebody comes to you and recognizes you for Kingdom of Hearts, because it's just kind of like this niche appreciation, and they're just such a genuine, actual fan.
Yeah. That fandom for that animated stuff is really intense too. Like,
oh, it's intense. Yeah. Yeah. I've done the Comic Cons.
Yeah. That Kingdom Hearts job was, like, by far the longest job I've ever had. Like, I started working on it about 20 years ago. So, and we've probably done 8 or 10 installments over all that time. And it's just wild to have that relationship with a character for so many years.
Right. But again, there's a lot of people who are fans of yours who don't even know that you're in that game.
Yeah.
And it's a revelation to them still.
Yeah.
But I really tip my hat to you for going and acting at the collegiate level like that. Did you find that there were at least enough worth mentioning individuals who were intimidated by your presence there, and you knew in your heart, hey man, I'm just here because I love this as much as you do, but maybe a teacher or a professor or or somebody who just kind of went out of their way to make you feel like, you know, like put you in your place?
No, luckily, no. And I definitely don't think anybody felt intimidated or weird in any way. And part of that was because the, you know, the program that we were in, the class sizes were really small. We had basically the same group of people the entire 4 years. Some people came in transfer track in third year, but you just build really, really close relationships with people, you know, right out of the gate. And I think like all with NYU's program, when you apply to Tisch, to the performing arts school, you can list, there's like 8 studios. It's changed a little bit over the year, but they all have a different sort of philosophy and a different sort of, you know, one's a musical theater studio and there's Meisner and Strasberg and all these things. And you can request the ones that you prefer, but they really work hard at placing people in the right studios. And I think for the most part, they placed really well, because not only were we in a program where we would thrive, but the group that they assembled worked really well with each other. Like they grouped us really well that year, because I graduated 10 years ago from that program, and we just had a Zoom with like 30 of us from the graduating class, and like everybody is, you know, everybody keeps in touch really well. So it's, I think I got really lucky with that.
I went to UCLA Film School and I talked to one person. Yes. Typical LA.
Is that program like, was that a program that was very solitary? Like it was, you know, easy to get isolated like that?
We came in as groups of 30. And I think I picked UCLA because my dad went there. Mm. And he went to the dental school. He didn't go to the film school, but still I had a nostalgic connection to the school.
Sure.
And I could also take Beverly Glenn and get to work.
Yeah.
So there was something a little bit more more attractive about that route than some of the other school options that I might have had. But I did run into, you know, some professors and, you know, assistant dean types that, you know, just kind of would always go out of their way to just kind of be like, you know, if we had to get an internship or something like that, I'm always like, can I get like one of my producers to sign off on this or whatnot? And it was like, no, I think you should participate like everyone else. It's like, well, what does that mean? Like I should demote myself at my current job just for your liking? Like, you know, I don't know. It's an LA thing too, though, because LA is like, I just feel like everybody wants to be somebody in LA. Yeah. But in a different way that New Yorkers are. Like LA people don't ever try like to bribe a hostess in LA. like if she wants to give you a better seat or up your reservation, she's gonna do it because she likes you.
Yeah.
In New York, they're almost looking for the hundo in your hand before it even comes out of your mouth, the request. You know I'm telling the truth.
It is different, yeah.
I love your young adult stories, though. Be real. Have you ever knowingly dated a fan?
No.
Like someone that never dated, like bottom line, somebody who fangirled out and you were just kind of like, you know what? You're hot and I don't care. I'm going to give this a shot.
That has never happened to me. I've never oh, done gosh. It. And in moving to New York, it was like, all right, like, you know, you meet a wide variety of people. And, but the number of times where I was like, you know what I have mostly dated actresses. That is mainly the thing that you end up dating the people that you're around the most, I guess, the type of person that you're around the most.
You date actresses?
I have. Yeah. It's been great.
I have a rule. No actresses. Like I created a rule around it. I was like, yo, we don't, the safest person around me is an actress. I have a buddy of mine that cracks me up when he says, you know, actresses, they always in character. Always in character.
That's a good saying.
Yo, oh, you're a better man than me for dating actresses, man. I remember one time I met this chick in San Francisco and she just had me smitten. And we had a great conversation, everything. And, you know, I fly back to LA and I do that thing where I try to keep in touch immediately. You know, I don't want her to think I forgot about her. And she hits me up and she says, hey, my friend's actually having a party like in a couple weeks. Like, do you think you'd want to come up for the party? And I'm like, damn, you know, I mean, she was that fly. You know, maybe I'll hop on a plane and just go spend the weekend up there and, you know, see what happens. And I said, yeah, what's up? Where's the party? And as soon as I showed any inkling of interest, it went from an invitation to a solicitation. And it was like, yeah, no, it's going to be like a 90s party. Like, you really want to come? And it was like, I was like, oh,
yeah.
Like, I just, like, my heart just crumbled, just like an old cookie on a kitchen table, man. Just,
yeah.
It just hurt, you know? It just,
yeah.
The shit hurt.
Yeah, that's not
and,
fun.
And you got to, it's that moment where you just kind of like start backing out of all interactions. Like, it's just, I'm not going to delete your contact now. But sometime soon,
yeah,
for my ego.
Yeah.
So when you moved out of the house, all right, did you feel prepared enough for life? Do you do your own grocery shopping? Do you go to the bank yourself?
Yeah, I felt pretty prepared. And then moving to a city like New York, you know, not really doing like a traditional campus and things like that, you're sort of immediately dropped into a real city instead of, you know, just hanging out on the quad. I don't think they have a quad at NYU, but yeah, you know, I've had a great accountant since I was like, God, I think it was like right when I started working, since I was 4 years old. So, you know, have someone I've trusted looking after the money stuff, but yeah, day-to-day life and, you know, figuring out a place to live and grocery shopping and cooking and all that. Like I've, you know, laundry and stuff like that. I've enjoyed being self-reliant with all of that. And part of it is because working on location kind of trains you to quickly set up those things. Like if you're dropped, if you're dropped in a city that's unfamiliar and, you know, you only have one day to get yourself settled in before you start working all day, every day, like you,
right.
It's good to be able to travel light and fast and to take care of that stuff yourself. That there's times where it's like you go somewhere, you'll start working, you're living out of a hotel, and like the first day where you can actually go to the grocery store and do your laundry is like the best thing ever, because normally you're coming home at like midnight and just been eating set food and like, you know, taking a couple granola bars back to have, you know, at the hotel.
Yep.
Like
I'm gonna go out on a limb and say you and I have both shopped at that grocery store downstairs from the Sutton Place in Vancouver.
Yes. Yes. What? There is no other city that where there's a lot of film and television that has a more centralized like hotel. Like everybody has stayed at that hotel. And every time I've been there, I'll see somebody I know in like the bar in the lobby down there. I always like peek my head in whenever I'm coming in or out because I know I'll probably see somebody I know. Lamorne and I did a pilot up there about 4 years ago. And yeah, that's where we were hanging out.
That's one of those rites of passage that if you haven't stayed at that hotel, I'm not sure you deserve to call yourself an actor yet. Not yet. You're getting there, but not yet. If you haven't had a Japo dog outside of the Sutton.
Yes. Yeah. The little hot dog stand. Yeah. Wow.
I love it. One of the things about you is that, that I noticed and I can tell that it has helped you tremendously is you've had such unusual consistency. So you said you had the same accountant from the time you were 4 years old. I know you had the same agent
for a really long
time. For like 20 years.
Yeah.
And are you still with her?
No, graduated college, Meredith Fine, she was at Coast to Coast. She was a fantastic agent, but Coast to Coast was still mostly a kids agency. So after I graduated, I went to a different agency, but yeah, that working with the same person for 20 years, yeah, building a relationship like that is just so invaluable. Yeah. And it helps you, you know, to be able to trust people. You know, there's all sorts of, you know, terrible things that can happen if you're working with someone that you can't trust. And I luckily have had the opposite experience.
When you're super recognizable, at least like we are, I mean, bottom line is people either, they typically know us right off the bat, whether you're a fan or not. It's like, oh, I know this guy. You know, how is that affected when workers come to your house and like, just talk about it. I'm not even gonna say anything because I'm like, I know what it feels like. So
I've like when it comes to people coming around the house, I lived in an apartment in New York, you know, until last fall. Yeah. So this is actually the first time I've moved to a house by myself. And a lot of it was happening. I was in a place temporarily when I came back to LA last year. And I just right when the pandemic was starting, had moved into the house where I'm in now. And it was bizarre because I kind of had to do it all by myself. I just have my little two-door car, and I was just slowly doing this move all by myself because, especially early on, I didn't want to expose any, you know, have anybody coming into the house or anything, or you know, put anybody in danger. So it was this very long, bizarre process. The only upside being that it was something to focus on, you know, when we were in lockdown. But now it's like when people come to do work and everything, or the gas companies here, like it's the mask. The mask is going to protect me forever.
Right?
People can't tell.
I just know my mom would always make me hide because if they saw my face, the price went up.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure that happened when I was a kid. Yeah. If people were coming around the house, I'm sure I was told to go play in the backyard or something.
Right. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? She'd be trying to grab every picture off the wall and always leave like one thing like, oh, the box of Urkelos on the top of the fridge. You know, that's just a box. I'm really envy the independence that you sought for yourself, though, in New York, because that's actually one of my career. You know, I'm not going to say regrets. I try not to use that word, but I just wish I could have gone back and just given it a shot is working on Broadway during my 20s in New York. I just think that would, I felt like we were the generation. Well, I feel like you're the last of the generations that felt a pressure from our parents to at least even attend college.
Yeah.
the new young stars don't feel any sense of I got to go to college at all.
Yeah.
It's like, dude, I got 2 million followers. Why am I on the quad with these clowns?
Yeah, the world has really changed with that. Because that, you know, and it's not just people who were working as actors when they were young. It's like for everybody, it was like, yeah, parents want you to go to college and get the degree and everything. And that has changed so much. And now, I mean, who knows what's going to be left of university education or college education, you know, now that, you know, they're going to be just bleeding money throughout the next year and a half or so. It's very, very strange. Yeah.
I know. I just got hustled by my daughter's school. They announced that we would be schooling on campus, and then they hit us all up for tuition. And then once they collected everybody's money, they said, you know what, we're thinking more about the online schools. Oh, you dirty bastards. Oh, the parents are so hot right now.
Bet.
We are all so heated right now. No discount, no nothing. Just run that check and we'll see you on Zoom. I'm like, wow.
Jeez.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
You worked with another buddy of mine. I told you, we got a lot of people in common.
I'm sure.
You worked with another buddy of mine, Derek Waters, a Drunk History.
Yeah, yeah. Love that show.
I freaking love Derek. Who did you play?
I played I forget the name of the figure, but it was a newsie. Me and Michael Cera were like newsboys in the early, like the 1910s or something, when there was a big action to unionize the newsboys. And my character was like a traitor who was paid off to fight the union and stuff like that, and then got my ass kicked by the newsies. So that kind of performance is so hard, though. No matter how prepared you think you are to get out there and do a bunch of action while matching, they're playing the narration on a big speaker and matching everybody's little idiosyncrasies. It's really challenging.
It's a totally different exercise. I think I've done 3 episodes now. But my favorite episodes, though, I did, I played Martin Luther King alongside Raven Simone.
Nice.
And then I also played Bass Reeves, who was a real badass cowboy, black guy who had just done all this stuff that nobody would have even known about.
Yeah.
And I was the lead in that one. And that was a really, really, really fun shoot. But you're right. It's a completely different exercise of acting. And I would walk around all day with my AirPods, and I did the recordings on my phone, and I've saved them on my phone. And then I would just, this is like before any of this TikTok technology. And then I would just play it over and over and over again and try to sync my lips to it.
Yeah.
So basically I just had I created my own playback on my phone.
Right.
And so that when they did playback on set, you know, it's done loud, I'm like, okay, I've already had that. I'm a repetition guy. Are you a guy that just likes to just keep it fresh? But I'm like, I like to drill it, drill it, drill it, drill it, drill it. And then kind of like ease up off the gas right before showtime.
Right. I think there's definitely something that there's an effect that it has doing like network television at a young age of learning to memorize things really quickly, because it's a, you know, it's a live show every week. So that definitely had a big influence on how I like to do things. I like to be completely off book as soon as possible. And if you really, you know, if there's something that needs a little bit more improvisation, or if you're not going to get a lot of rehearsal with people, having it kind of drilled down almost makes that easier in a way. So yeah, there's special circumstances where, but it really in every case, like when it comes to the lines, like I like to have it down. Like there's some things I'll rehearse a little bit harder than others, you know, if you want to keep it fresh, like you said, but yeah, with the dialogue, I'm always like to have it down.
I know James Rodet from Psych.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've met James ever. James literally has a photographic memory.
Wow.
Like he can just quick glance at a half a page and it's just like done.
Wow.
Like have you ever worked with anybody acting wise that just made you feel like I got to get my skills up? Like this guy's on a whole nother level. Like I watched James Spader on Boston Legal, you know, do his 2-page monologue.
Oh yeah.
And it was just like, this guy could back that thing forwards and back it up forward, move it forward and back it up like it was a car, like it was a vehicle. It was just like he had such command over the 2 pages.
Yeah.
But back to the question, yeah. Like if there's anybody that impressed you that you just like you saw an aspect of their game you wanted to add to yours.
It's kind of strange because it was so long ago, but I do remember that it was so obvious what a dedicated performer Tom Hanks was, that like even as a 4-year-old, I remember it being like a set is a fun place to hang out on and like make conversation with people and everything. And he was very nice, but like between every take, he was in his director's chair just studying the script like so, so intently. That was one of the early, you know, probably the first time I'd ever seen an example of that on set. And it made a huge impression on me. But yeah, I've gotten to, with comedy, there's a lot of people that I was enjoying working with them, but also was like trying to soak up as much as I could because, you know, they're just obviously so, so great at what they do. Kristen Wiig was an example of that. I worked with Matt Walsh in the first movie I did with Lamorne in Sex Ed. He's just a wonderful, like truly gifted, you know, master improvisers like that. It should be intimidating, but they're so good that it makes it easier for you because they're just bringing you along with them. That's made a big impression on me too. Yeah.
I generally find that the biggest stars are the sweetest people and the smallest stars are the biggest assholes.
You know,
I swear it has really held true in so many instances. I mean, nothing is 100%, but it just really has.
Yeah. I've been lucky in a way, but also like I feel like I've missed out on, you know, I've never really had a bad experience with a star or with any kind of actor where you certainly hear some stories on other films. You know, obviously there are productions that are, you know, more difficult than others, but I've never had an experience where working with someone was a nightmare the way that you hear sometimes.
Knock on wood, you don't.
Yeah.
I love that you openly say though, how much you love it. You love acting. Like I feel like it's just in your DNA from your dad.
Yeah.
And you genuinely love it. And I'll be real with you, like just, you know, just got a guy. Like I've had mixed emotions as I've gotten older with the roller coaster of it.
Sure.
I love the craft of it. I love the exercise.
Yeah.
When it's done right, like I mean those Drunk History days are fun. You know, doing episodes of Psych are just they're so memorable. The guys I was working with, but you know, how do you manage the roller coaster of it all from, you know, working with Steven Spielberg one day and then, at least for me, auditioning for Hawaii 5-0 the next week, and like how do you manage how do you manage auditioning while famous?
I think I always had an understanding that you know, nothing is ever certain, that you're not, you know, things are not going to be handed to you, and that there's just so much uncertainty and randomness in how certain things come to you. And also that because I, you know, everybody got to know me when I was a younger actor, that you would constantly have to be update. Like people will have a tendency to see you as that character from their memory and not from how old you are now and things like that. It takes a long time to move past people's first impressions. So when you're doing a show or a studio film or something like that, it's going to be a long, protracted process to get that done. So I just try and treat auditions as opportunities to, you know, to improve and get better, because it's so different from when you're on set working. Because when you're on set working, you're trying to create something that's real or something that's funny, or you know, you're able to work in a more organic way. Auditions, there's this, you're trying to find the strategy that works, and you're often dealing with a decision that's going to be made with a bunch of people who don't necessarily agree with each other or want the same thing. You know, you have different producers want something, or the writer director wants something, and the network wants something else, or the studio wants something else. So it's a much more inorganic process that, you know, can be frustrating, but it's what we have to deal with, particularly now with, you know, there was supposed to be that WGA strike this year, and, you know, SAG is in negotiation right now. Just all these factors where it feels like in many professions right now that there's, you know, a weakening of, you know, of the worker, I guess, where now that the industry, so many things are being run by companies that come from the tech side of things and not from the entertainment side of things. It's everything is done by an algorithm now. And it's just the actors have less and less power to build a career in the way that they used to. You know, you're kind of at the mercy of the algorithm now. And obviously we've been very lucky in our lives. And it doesn't compare to all the horrible things happening to unions in other parts of the economy where people's lives are at stake. But it is part of a trend where it's just like the biggest companies are sort of squeezing everybody from the top down.
And Brad, you really just touched on a gem right there. I took a job on Netflix because I needed to boost my Netflix algorithm.
Right.
And ultimately, you know, I always joke, I was like, Netflix is really just YouTube for famous people. it really is. It's like, this is, you know, if I can get my views up to Adam Sandler's level, man, we can chill.
Well, when they released those numbers recently about how many people had watched various shows, and a lot of the shows you're like, well, I didn't hear anybody talking about this, or like, I didn't see anybody, and 100 million people watched this show. Like, it's similar to so many news sites where Facebook was using fake data to drive them into using more video content. So they fired a bunch of like writers and reporters because they're like, this is what people want. People want to watch, you know, little videos of the news. Not, you know, I'm not explaining it very well. But what happened was that Facebook was using faulty data. So people weren't actually looking for that. And by the time this came to light, all these newsrooms had completely transformed themselves, fired a bunch of people, and had gone to more video content and everything, when that it wasn't even what people desired. So when I hear things, when it's like Netflix has a lot of focus on the color, the background color of the tile of the show throughout the day or in different regions in the world, there is an intricate algorithm that shows that you're more likely to click on this, you know, Bird Box or something, if it turns red in the morning, if you're watching in the morning, or if it's late at night.
No.
If the background's orange. There's so much money and effort and energy going into those little tricks. When I, you know, as an actor, you're just like, well, why can't all that effort go into just making good shows? Which they do very often.
Big data is driving everything.
Yeah.
Just micro mining the human brain and what it could be attracted to sell you something or whatever. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's facts right there. When I feel like when you're us though, also people expect us to stay in contact with our co-stars more than someone else. Right. Like, so when people see you in their minds, it's like, oh, you're just going to call up Bruce Willis tomorrow. Right. You know, you're going to, and it's like, no, dog, it's Hollywood is very transient. You know, it's like any workplace.
Even if you want to, it's hard because you're getting sent to different places, around the country, around the world. Even if, you know, you're in LA at the same time, if you're working on a show, that's kind of all you're doing for the time being. So when it does happen, when you're able to build those relationships with people that you've worked with or work with them on multiple shows, that's the best. But a lot of the time it's tough because you are sucked into this working environment for several months where you're seeing someone every hour of every day. And then at the end of it, everybody has to part their separate ways. So that's a tough thing that happens for us.
I heard that Meryl Streep has a rule that she said has kept her family together. And she said she doesn't believe in after work dinners. She's like, she said that's when the shenanigans always get started on a movie set, is the, hey, let's go eat.
Yeah.
And she's like, there is no, hey, let's go eat, Meryl. Not for me. And I thought that was, I always thought that was very insightful, because it really is the truth when you think about it. And I was, at that point, I realized, I was like, well, I'm just going to have to do better in life, because I'm never going to pass on, hey, let's go eat. I'm never going to pass. Yeah.
Some of my favorite parts of working on location. Let's go eat.
Exactly. I've heard that your favorite curse word is fuck. And if you weren't an actor, you'd be in politics.
Oh, gosh. The politics ones. I don't know anymore. Like, it looks like a pretty horrible, horrible thing. Either you have to be just pure evil. The only people that seem to really be enjoying that are pure evil. And everybody else, it's a dark time for politics.
Yeah, it's a dark time. I will go there.
And I guess I am a little hopeful that there is some younger Congress people that have come in recently who seem to accept, as we all do, that it's a job in a horrible industry, and that most of the people in politics are terrible and everything, but it hasn't really mattered. They're still going to try and do the right thing. I like AOC, and there's a man, Jabari Brisport, who is still in the runoff for his election. He was at ETW while I was there. And just seeing people who it's such a big sacrifice to go into politics if you're doing it for the right reasons. You know, there's plenty of people going into politics on the other side to get rich and to sell out to big industry and stuff like that. But if you're truly going to try and improve people's lives, that is a tough, thankless job. So I admire a lot of these younger people who are going to try and stop the bleeding.
I really get the sense that there's this, there's also a battle going on in our country between boomers and Gen Z.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's not being publicized quite as much, but the fact of the matter is, I feel like boomers are really trying to hold on to power and they're trying to hold on to power with ideals that have faded.
Yeah.
And then Gen Z is like, hey, wait a minute, that's not right. You know, like, what do you, and it's like, you even see some of these Gen Zers even protesting with, like, you know, with BLM or whatnot. And it's a real awakening, because you'll see like a white guy get shoved in the face by a cop or whatever. Yeah. And all of a sudden, you know, the light goes on different. It was like, oh, yeah, no, you could catch it too.
Yeah.
You know, it's not as, from the cop standpoint, it's not as racist as it is authoritarian.
Yeah.
And a system in place that refuses to yield. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So it's like, I don't know. I still see that as like the number one conflict in our country right now is just between young and old in terms of ideals, and old people trying to hold on to a lot of power.
Yeah. That's who's, you know, in charge, and you know, that's all those judges and senators and, you know, and most presidents are really elderly men recently. So it's going to take a lot of energy from the younger generations. And I think the big one that hangs over all of it, even though it's a little bit farther in the future, is that for the elderly, like, climate change is not as big a problem as someone who's 20 years old right now, or someone who wants to have kids right now. And I think that's going to be a big flashpoint for people saying, you know, this is something we need to take seriously now. You know, and I know that a lot of the people fighting are like, I'm not going to be around, who cares? It's like, well, some people are going to be around. So yeah, with all I've been really pleasantly surprised that people have stuck with the protests with the police and everything, especially under the circumstances where there's that frightening virus out there, and people have still stayed out there. And, you know, it's obvious as skeptical as I have been of smartphones in culture, one definite good with it is that people are now forced to see all of these violent incidents that happen all the time. Like, if it weren't for these records, people might have ignored some of these things. And now you're just seeing in the first weeks of those protests, just constant violent attacks on peaceful protesters. You know, now they're being abducted in Portland by the secret police. It's just, it's become
very, I heard about
yeah,
that too.
It's terrible. It's become really clear what everyone is up against.
Well, I don't think the abuses that we're catching on film are getting worse. They're being filmed.
Right. Yeah.
That's the
difference. It's always been happening.
I think it's always been happening, but now it's in our face.
Yeah.
How many daily conflicts we have over minutia and just lack of common courtesy, to be quite honest. Do you feel that in your career, though, that watching the younger executive move into power has helped your career? Because I do feel, I'm feeling a shift. Like I'm starting to work with my age-old peer now.
Yeah.
As opposed to being judged by somebody who maybe is, you know, 20 years older than me, 15 to 20 years older than me, and they have more respect for the cast of Friends. You know what I'm saying? It's like, oh yeah, those guys can do no wrong, but you know, but these guys over here, you know, they just see us differently. I'm really seeing it affect my career for the better, to be quite honest, the younger executive that's moving into power.
I think so, definitely. Part of my reason for wanting to move back to LA was that I'm trying to get more on the producing side of things and trying to pitch some of my own projects and everything. And when you are talking, I mean, it doesn't matter what, there's some people of all ages that can be receptive to a good idea, but it is often a lot easier when you are in the same generation as someone to sort of explain what you're after and to sort of explain where you're coming from. And I'm definitely starting to see that too. Yeah.
It's like when I saw you on Silicon Valley, it's like, I was happy to see you on Silicon Valley, but I was also happy to see you looking and behaving and acting so different.
Yeah.
That's, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, that's what I was gassed off of. It wasn't like an appearance, like, oh, I'm just seeing him over there. I was seeing a maturation.
Yeah.
And I was also seeing your full skill set. You know what I'm saying?
Thanks.
Now I was like, okay, I could put some of his performances in context now. And I just saw you going to a William H. Macy kind of place. You know what I'm saying? In your own career.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? In terms of the diversity of what your work will ultimately become.
Sure.
What's your biggest vice?
Biggest vice? Gosh. Probably watching sports now. That's something that, you know, with baseball the last couple of years, it's like I've been going to a lot of Dodger games, watching a lot of that stuff. That's something that each year I'm like, all right, I'm going to try and let a couple games go without watching every single inning. I started keeping score and stuff like that.
No,
yeah,
no, that's a boomer activity.
Really
not with the pen and not with the scorecard and the pencil.
Yep.
No,
it's always old guys you see doing that at Dodger Stadium. Yeah,
that's a boomer move. That's a boomer move. Oh my gosh! At least do it on your phone.
Yeah.
No, come on.
No, I gotta save it. I got it's for the memories.
That's okay. So maybe I heard wrong. I heard that you were a notorious procrastinator.
Oh, I guess so. I think I've gotten better at that, though. I think I used to be worse. You know, I do
have
religiously.
A kid. It'll get worse.
Yeah. Yeah.
So have a kid. It'll get worse.
I'm sure. Yeah. I've got to be prepared for that. No, even though the phone notes app is really helpful for me now, I still will sometimes keep a post-it in my wallet if I got to make sure I get certain things done in a day or a week. So I've tried to combat that.
That's awesome. If you had one professional do-over when you were a kid, like, what would it be?
Wow.
You know, not like anything you regret, but just like, if I could go back and do this differently, if I could go back and, is there a role or something that you didn't get that maybe you wish you could go back and get something similar? Because I noticed you said you like playing villains now at this point.
Yeah. You know, because I guess that would be related to that, because my dad and I were both always like, wouldn't it be fun to play like a dark role like that? Because I think I was mostly known for playing kids that, you know, we're good and moral and like we're trying to do the right thing all the time. And we were like actively looking like, let's try something a little bit more complicated. And it was hard to find. And it was hard to find something that really that ticked that box. I had to wait until I was older to get that. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think people realize that, you know, kids are selected. We rarely get developed for.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, that's a huge difference in career. And it doesn't even matter how hot you are. You could be the hottest guy there is as a kid,
yeah.
You know, but you get treated like one from a development standpoint that it's like, we will access your fame as we need for our project, but we're not going to build anything to show off what your skill set is. You know, there were certain people like yourself, Dakota Fanning. I remember I loved her performance in Man Down. And I felt like I was watching a mini adult.
Yeah.
I really did. So when she's done with a movie like that, though, there is no system in place that says we're going to develop the next Dakota Fanning project.
Right.
You know, it's what box can we put her in next? What does she fit that's already in existence? And that's where this generation with social media and just technology has such an advantage over our generation.
Yeah.
Because we had to conform.
Yeah.
You know, we had to mold around the projects that were already in existence.
Right. Yeah, I'm surprised.
All right, this
Sorry,
is just
go ahead.
No.
I'm surprised even today with actors of various ages where I think I was even reading something with like Robert Pattinson recently, where it's like someone who's done a huge variety of work recently and still has to fight against certain elements trying to get you to do the same thing over again. Like they've identified yep. what they want from you and they just want that over and over again. It's like that's something that affects yep. people at all points in their career, no matter how successful
yeah,
you are.
All levels of the business.
Yeah.
A-list, B-list, pay your rent list, whatever.
Yeah.
Just, I get that. What was I going to ask you, kid? I had a good one, man. The internet. What do you love about it? What do you hate about it?
I definitely hate the intrusion into everybody's private life. Like, that's just across the board. It's like this stuff that you don't even want to know about people, and yet now you have to know about it. Like, this, you know, digging into people's relationships and personal lives. That's definitely, I think, been a net negative. But what I love about it is what they promised us when we were in elementary school, that you can get access to all the best information. You could learn anything you want to.
Oh,
and that's
man.
Still true.
Right?
It's still, you know, the information is still out there to learn a skill or yeah. With basic day-to-day stuff now, where it's like, I could access any recipe in the world and be taught how to cook it like from YouTube or something like that. That still is amazing.
Yeah.
We just didn't realize all the other stuff that was going to come with it.
You're right. We had newspaper clippings and World Book and Britannica.
Yeah, yeah. And Carta on the old IPMs. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, man. How much life has changed.
Yeah.
All right, I just got one more thing. I'm not going to hold you up entirely, man. This has been so much fun to speak to somebody that I just instantly knew I'd be able to relate
to. It's so great talking
but
to you, too.
Screw acting for a second.
Sure.
All right? Let's just pretend we didn't need our SAG healthcare. If you could spend your days doing three things that didn't even mean you had to make money doing them, but you just spend your days doing these three things, what would they be?
I'd be playing guitar, scuba diving. That's a hobby I don't get to do as much as I'd like. And I guess going to see live music is like that really kept me in New York as well. Like you'd be able to see a great live show every night of the week if you wanted to. And like that would be a perfect day to me, you know, playing a little music, seeing a little music, getting in the ocean.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that. Okay. I think I would play basketball and ping pong every day.
Nice.
I would travel all over the place just eating the best of everything.
Oh yeah.
And this is why you know Lamorne and I are friends. I would go on daily adventures with the most athletic women I
know. Perfect.
With you, dude. Seriously, dog. Thank you for just having a chat, dog.
You got
this
it.
Was fun.
This was really fun. I hope we get to hang out in person sometime. It's in the future.
Now that I know that that you weren't just passing through as a celebrity spectator, and you really do play ping pong, I know I'm supposed to go over Seth Green's. And play ping pong.
Oh, nice.
So I will make sure to text you when that happens.
Fabulous.
Are you a text guy
yeah.
or are you a voicemail
I'm
guy?
I'm a text guy, definitely. But you can leave a voicemail if that's how you like to do things, too.
Cool beans. All right, well, take care, man.
All right, nice talking to you.
This
you take
awesome.
Care, too.
Cheers to a great day and this ice-cold Corona.
You know what would make this day even better? My grandma's carne asada.
Throw in some music.
We can watch the game. Or we could keep it simple.
Corona, la vida más fina. Get your Corona at ordercorona.com. Relax responsibly. Corona Extra Beer, imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.